Where were you living during the war?
I was living in Spring Grove.
And how old were you at that time?
I think the war started pretty much around 41, 42 that I was aware of. And then I worked at the telephone office. So I worked there till I was a senior in high school, except for one summer. I think I started working there when I was in sixth grade, and I started out at 15 cents an hour. And in our town, we had it was a stucco building with two glass enclosed telephone booths, and then the switchboard was in a little separate roped-off area. And then we also took in the dry cleaning, and we wrote the news stories for the paper in our town and the paper in the town next to us. And then the family lived in the rest of the house. There were two bedrooms and a living room bath upstairs, and downstairs was the kitchen.
So, how did your responsibilities as a telephone operator change once the war started?
Well, most of the calls that came in from servicemen were kind of hard to understand. The lines weren't really good, and so we interpreted for them quite a bit, especially if it was a country line that they were calling.
How aware were you of the war that was already going on before Pearl Harbor was attacked?
Not too much. I can't just remember the years on some of these things. I do remember the boy that lived next door to us. His father was the telegraph man at the depot, and they received a telegram that he had been killed in action. He went down in the English Channel. So that was the first real awareness, of a very tragic thing. The Legion Post is named after him. And of course, the father was the depot agent, so he brought the telegram home. And then I think one of the very next ones was to a family that had three boys in service. And the depot agent brought the telegram over to the telephone office and said, "You'll have to deliver this." And so my boss said, "Well, Jean, you'll have to take it, get a bike and drive over." It was on the other end of town, and deliver this telegram. And of course, I did what she told me to. And I remember going up to her home, and her husband wasn't home. It was in the afternoon, and she had three stars, blue stars on her window. And so I knocked on the door and gave her the telegram. And as far as I can figure out, I was either 13 or 14 at that first delivery. Well, then it wasn't very long after that that they had another one to this home. And so, of course, I had to get on the bike and go again. And this one was missing in action. But when I delivered it, she saw me coming up the stairs, and I remember she had parted the lace curtain, and she put her hand up to her face, and she knew what was going to happen. And so, of course, I started to cry a little bit and told her I was very sorry to have to deliver this second one. And then when I got back to the telephone office, I said, I don't want to deliver those anymore. Somebody else is going to have to. Well, this was, you know, a new experience for our town, and the then the Legion dressed in their caps and things, and they delivered it. There usually went two or three of them to the homes after that. Then the third boy in that family was captured, and he was a prisoner of war in Germany. He was in Stalag, if you've heard of that. Stalag, I think it's 13, Stalag 13. He was one of the first group of men that crossed the Rhine. He was a radio operator. So that family had some pretty hard things happen to them during the war. We used to get quite a few phone calls from servicemen who were trying to locate their mother. And usually, if they couldn't get them at home, they'd cut into the telephone office and say they'd want help. And they'd say, Jean or Janora, whoever was working, do you suppose she'd be someplace in town that you would know? And, well, yes, she had circle today, so I can call her at the church. So then we'd get them connected up that way. Or maybe they were, you know, someplace else that we knew about at the school or something, whatever was going on.
The family, the mother with the three sons, did any of the three sons make it home?
Yes, the second one came home. He had been missing in action. And can you believe the third one came home also? And they lived in town quite a while. One time I had a phone call from a serviceman, and he couldn't hear out in the country. And he asked if I'd interpret for him. And I said, all right, I would. What do you want to tell her? And he said, well, this is my girlfriend. Tell her that I love her. And I said, okay, I'll tell her. And so I said, your friend wants to tell you that he loves you. Oh, she said, tell him I love him too. So I cut back in and said, she loves you too. Oh, well, ask her if she'll marry me. Okay, so I asked if she'd marry him. Yes, tell him I will. So then the rest of the conversation was making arrangements when he'd get a leave and when they could get married and so forth. That was kind of fun, too. Some of the calls were really fun for them to get a hold of their loved ones. There were some that were calling the Red Cross, and they sometimes needed help because they didn't know just where the Red Cross was at that time. Especially right after the war, when some of the men were like in hospitals around the country. I know I had a cousin who had a husband who was in a hospital down in Texas. And they got a hold of him through the Red Cross.
Were there any other difficult telephone calls that you had to translate?
I just don't remember now. There was so much going on. And I guess you kind of say, well, I'll remember this the rest of my life. And then some of the things that happen, you can't remember everything. I had to learn numbers in Norwegian and English. A lot of people still spoke Norwegian before the war really got really bad. And it was considered the first Norwegian settlement in Minnesota, so just about everybody until after the war when some of the new brides came home. It was all Norwegian, pretty much. We did write a lot of letters because the servicemen really appreciate the letters, and we sent a lot of care packages, as much as we could. Sometimes I'd send 10, 12, 13 letters to servicemen, and of course you had to watch your pennies because you had to buy stamps for all those things. We saved foil and cord and a lot of things that we send in, cooking oil, anything like that. We had, and then of course we had the blackouts, and when they first started practicing them, I remember they came to our door. I was home, and they said, "We can see through your dining room windows. You have to have them more secure." So of course we got some blankets and things and put up, but they really did a lot of the blackouts there for a while, and then sometimes you could see chimney fires quite a bit around that time. Most people had furnaces that they fed themselves and stoked and so forth, and sometimes those houses would catch fire from the sparks coming out. So everybody always, when they were out at night, looked for chimney fires. But in a blackout, they didn't want any chimney fires showing up.
Were you ever afraid during this time that you would be attacked?
Well, I can't say that I was. I just knew we were safe. I know we all cried a lot for our friends. I had a lot of, when I got in high school, a lot of the fellows joined service and went off to war. Had a lot of cousins. Oh, I remember one day we had a picnic, and there were three of the girl cousins going into service, and four of the boy cousins going into service. And out of those boys, the one boy was very heavily damaged with flak, and he lost an eye, and he was wheelchair bound. But he went on to marry his nurse and have two children. And then the other son in the family, my other cousin, was in England in a hospital. And then the third boy was on Iwo Jima. And then the fourth boy in that family was in the Marines twice, called back into the Marines again. And that was a close family to us. My husband was a bombardier navigator flying out of Italy. He flew over 50 missions, and he had actually two Purple Hearts and quite a few citations and things. Right now, he's in the nursing home with Alzheimer's, so he's been there 2 years now.
Did you meet him after the war was over?
Yeah, I did. I met him in a little church in Evanston, and he was going to optometry school in southern Chicago. And he came up to visit his brother, who sang in the choir too, and so that's how we met. And so he said when he left, he wanted me to go with him back to either South Dakota or Iowa. He was going to take both boards. And so we ended up here where he had, his father was raised here in this town.
Did the war change you at all?
I guess you could almost say I kind of grew up with it, you know. As now, like my oldest cousin that had lost an eye, he'd had over 100 surgeries for shrapnel. And he said, people ask me if I am angry or bitter. And he said, I never felt that way. I always felt it was a privilege to go into service and fight for my country. And I think most of the boys that I knew had that same feeling. And it was a solace to those left behind. I know there were a lot of tears and sadness. You'd hear about your friends, you know.
Did you ever feel angry or bitter while you were at home that you maybe had to change things about the way you lived your day-to-day life when the war came?
No, I don't think so. We just went on the way we were. We put on plays and operettas and school and church programs, and we sang a lot of patriotic things. And I remember one time I gave a declam in school called Joe Smith American, and received a superior rating on it, and gave it to a number of organizations around. And yeah, we were all very patriotic. We didn't question whether it was right or wrong. We did what we had to do, and I think that's what our boys all did too at that time. I look back now and see things with the Japanese that were confined out in California, and I'm afraid if something like that would have happened to me, I might have a different feeling. But I still lived in the same house, still had the same, you know, friends pretty much, and everything was pretty much routine.
How did you feel about the Japanese at the time of the war?
Well, of course, we wanted the war to stop. We wanted it to end. We were grateful to have it end. I guess that's the way I would say. We didn't have, you know, any animosity toward a certain group. In fact, my grandfather lived with us, and he used to have different political meetings, go to them, and he was kind of a politician, so to speak. But he said one time, this one little town, mostly Germans living in it, and some of the people from the next town were giving them bad time. And he said he told them that they shouldn't do that, that they were as good an American as anyone. And, you know, but you did have relatives fighting relatives during that war, whether it was Germany or Japan, you know.
What do you think we need to remember about World War II?
Oh, the losses, the devastation. My young son-in-law was over in Okinawa, and we traveled the Orient just for one instance, looking at some of the things that did happen during the war overseas. Oh, it must just been devastating. Okinawa, our friend down the street, was there when the Japanese were being overtaken, and they were just jumping off cliffs, you know. That death march and Bataan. Knew someone on that. It wasn't very pleasant to hear about. Or, like, we were in Rome, and we were in a part that had not been reconstructed. They still had the ropes where they hung Mussolini, and I don't know if his wife or and you know, all the windows out and the buildings black. Same way up in Russia where we traveled one time. I mean, you see some of the things that happened over there, and it did not happen here. My mother was selected as honorary dame of the town. She's deceased now, but and the man that was he was called the honorary Norwegian. He took quite a while to get up there. The little Nesses were helping him up the stage, and he said, "Well, you probably don't know why I'm limping, but," he said, "I've never talked about it." And that was true of so many of the people that had been in service. They didn't talk about it for a long time. But he said, "We were rescuing people in little boats, and most of them were Jewish, out of Norway." And he said the Germans didn't see us, and they had a big boat waiting for them around the bend, sort of. And he said, "I tripped on a root of a tree, and I broke my leg. And they tried to take me on the boat, and he said, I couldn't go. And I told them to go ahead." And they went ahead. Well, then the Germans heard it, and so they fired at them. Of course, Norway wasn't taken over for very long, but when they came, they really took it over. And so he said, "I hid there, and I set my own leg." And they came back one more time and picked me up. And he said, "I got out of there."